Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
This is Tom Marshall with Osiris, here to tell you that Freak Flag Flying is brought to you by Pilsner Urquell Beer. In 1842, Pilsner Urquell brewed the world's first golden Pilsner in the city of Pilsen in the Czech Republic. It is still brewed in the same brewery today, using the same Czech ingredients. There are a lot of crazy beers out there these days, and sometimes I just need a lager, specifically a Pilsner. Pilsners I find to be crisper and cleaner tasting than other beer types, and Pilsner Urquell I feel has the formula just right. It's not fruity or bitter or overhopped. The malt and hop flavors are just balanced perfectly. They've had 178 years to perfect it. You should give it a try. Pilsner Urquell makes sure that all their beer arrives in the U.S. in less than 31 days. The product is refrigerated the entire time from the brewery in Pilsen to the distributor warehouse in the U.S. to ensure the beer tastes the same here as it does in the brewery in Pilsen. You can find Pilsner Urquell in your local grocery store, available in cans and brown bottles for freshness. To enjoy Pilsner Urquell at its best, consider pouring it into a Pilsner mug. Thank you, Pilsner Urquell. Hello, this is Tom Marshall from Osiris, and welcome to the final installment of Freak Flag Flying. In this episode, I speak with a host of Freak Flag Flying, Steve Silberman, and discuss his path from diehard music fan to best-selling author, and the influence of beat poets on both David Crosby's generation and on Steve personally, and much more. And as usual, we'll be playing some very rare music that you can only hear on this podcast. So there's a few things left to be said, and there are a few songs left to be played, but mainly, I love talking to you every opportunity I can. Hello, Steve.
Hey, Tom, and it's totally mutual, buddy, I've got to say. This has been a wonderful experience for both me and Crosby, judging from his phone calls, and also for Osiris Media listeners, judging from the sheer volume of very sweet tweets and emails we've been receiving. I also got to spend 4 full days with David and his wife Jan in the beautiful Santa Ynez Valley as we tape these podcasts, which was a once-in-a-lifetime experience for a lifelong Crosby fanatic. I've also been very happy to turn people on to the extraordinary renaissance of David as a songwriter and performer in the recent era. None of his peers, and we're talking about full-on geniuses like Neil Young, have been so prolific and so committed to pushing the music forward. I don't think anyone, least of all David himself, would have expected this when he was struggling with his cocaine addiction back in the 1980s. I remember weeping while reading a headline in Spin magazine in those dark times, "The Death of David Crosby." Well, all I can say is, I checked, and the poor journalist who wrote that piece passed away some time ago, while David has put out 4 of the best albums of his entire career in the past 5 years alone. It's one of the most thrilling and underappreciated stories in the history of rock and roll. Now, I'd like to take this opportunity to play one of my favorite songs from one of those recent albums, a song called Radio from David's album Cross, released in 2014. It's a song about people helping people, which we need more than ever at this time in history, God knows. It's an awesome song with lyrics by David and music by his son, James Raymond.
Just like in the movies, a message comes through all the static in his, pulling just enough words from the storm-filled sky to know that someone somewhere needs this. The radio runs to the wheelhouse, got that message held tight in his fist, an SOS off to the wireless, saying someone, someone.
I love that song, and we're going to be playing more wonderful tracks in this podcast, including a couple of extreme rarities that are not in circulation in trading circles and hardly anyone's ever heard. Now, Tom, this podcast series would never have happened without a renaissance of our own, the renaissance of our friendship, which began way back in the early 1990s. Back then, I was writing a book with David Shank called Skeleton Key, A Dictionary for Deadheads, which became sort of a cult favorite. At the time I wrote it, Jerry Garcia was still alive and the Dead were still on the road, but I was already hearing about another band with a funny name that everyone was saying did some heavy-duty jamming, as the Dead did, but in their own way and with their own distinctive style. I'm talking about Phish, of course. It was before the band became the huge phenomenon that it now is. They were still playing little theaters and whatnot. But when I saw them at the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco in 1991, I knew they had the stuff. I remember thinking, this is the last time I'll see them in a venue as tiny as this. And indeed, it was so. In fact, After I met my future husband online, Ward Q Normal on Twitter, we dated by going on fish tour together. So for my book Skeleton Key, I reached out to the handsome young lyricist of this young band, whose name was Tom Marshall, and asked you to do an email interview about the parallels between the dead and fish, which was a nearly absurdly fraught topic of debate at the time. I loved your answers so much, I just put them in the book verbatim because I thought they really expressed the essence of the fish lyric sensibility. For example, when I asked you what inspired you to write a lyric like Stash, you replied, "A castaway, asleep on a rock in the middle of the Aegean, dreams of the great flood and his polar opposite, his familiar, a goldfish named Trout." Several years later, that same set of circumstances befall him again, this time as he's packing his designer Sumatran luggage, rescue style. It was hilarious, man. Then we met and got along really well. Do you remember what we did?
Oh, man. Well, first of all, that was a pretty strange quote you got from me. But I guess Stash is a pretty strange song. But yes, I totally remember that day, Steve. Some of my pals and I met you in New York City. We took a wonderful walk through the East Village, seeing sights and getting into alternate frames of mind. And I remember in particular stopping at the door of the Fillmore East, all boarded up. And it kind of had special memories for all of us. For me, the Allman Brothers album immediately started playing in my head.
Oh, totally, totally. But as time went on, you and I both went our separate ways. Fish became huge. Things happened, including me and my husband seeing dozens of more great fish shows together. And we just sort of fell out of touch with each other. But then, last year, at Trey's Ghosts of the Forest show at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, one of my friends said, "Wow, there's Tom Marshall." And I said, "Oh yeah, we used to be pals, but I suspect he doesn't even remember me." And the next thing I knew, you were hugging me from behind and suggesting I do a podcast for Osiris. That put me in a great mood for the whole show.
Wow. Well, I usually charge a little extra for that, but I agree. It was a great show, and it was great to see you again. So, Steve, you have a weird life. You mentioned before you're well-known in the jam band community as being an old-school Deadhead and fish fan who wrote Skeleton Key and was interviewed for the Dead documentary Long Strange Trip. But you're also the New York Times best-selling author of the history of autism called Neurotribes. And very few people realize that you wrote both books. From the outside, they seem like extremely different kinds of subjects. Is there any connection between them?
I'm so glad you asked me that, because so few people know that I wrote both books that I hardly ever get asked a question like that. And the thing is, both Deadheads and people on the autism spectrum are sort of marginalized, even stigmatized, misunderstood communities. They were, or they are, communities of people who create a lot of meaning by hanging out with each other and understand each other really well, but are very not understood from the outside. So in a sense, both Neurotribes and Skeleton Key are about these communities that society has sort of overlooked or ignored or actively stigmatized or bullied, but actually have a profound experience of life in their own communities. And so in a sense, that's the connection between both books.
That's great. And you and several people I know were Deadheads who were becoming fish heads. And it was kind of strange for me when people come to fish from the Dead, because I was never a real huge Deadhead. I mean, I did manage to see 5 shows, I think, in total with Jerry Garcia. Once at MSG, and then around a few other places, RFK Stadium, memorably, and the Meadowlands. And most of these were with Trey.
Can you remember any anecdotes about seeing the Dead with Trey?
Oh, boy. I do remember sort of like I was referring to resolving that I needed to know this music better. But I kind of never really followed through with that. I wish I knew then what I know now, kind of thing. But Trey was just always such a musical sponge, and he would know so much more about every band we saw together from The Dead to King Crimson to Pat Metheny to Wynton Marsalis. And he was impossible to keep up with musically then, as he still is. Steve, you said that you were a Crosby fan even before you were a Deadhead.
That's true.
In episode one, you talked with David about hearing Guinevere in Provincetown when you were a teenager, and it blew your mind. What else made you fall in love with his music so much?
Well, CSNY's Deja Vu was the first album I ever bought with my own money at EJ Corvettes on Long Island, if anybody remembers what that was. But yeah, that first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album that's known as the Couch album because the guys are sitting on a sofa on the cover, that album was like a world that I wanted to live in. Now, what I'd like to do is treat our listeners to an outtake from the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album that very few people have ever heard, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. Let's listen.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to be free.
Wow, Blackbird. Well, that's totally one of those great White Album Paul songs that I love so much. And it seems like that one gets covered by so many people. You know, I've heard it like on the TV show Glee that my kids used to watch. And my son had to learn it on guitar, so I learned it. But I also have like a Carly Simon version, a Sarah McLachlan version. There's tons of versions of that, but I never heard this before. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think they probably left it off the first album because that way all of the songs on that album they would have written themselves. But they obviously love the song because they also sang it at Woodstock just a few months after the Beatles version came out. But nobody Wow. realized or remembered that they sang it at Woodstock until this box set came out last year, the complete Woodstock that had it on it. I did want to ask you, Tom, what have you learned about Crosby's music or about Crosby himself from this podcast series?
Oh, man. Well, it kind of made me realize how little I knew of him in reality. So I learned a whole lot about him from this podcast. You know, things you don't learn just by listening to the music about his viewpoints, and he's quite outspoken. But mainly it seems that he's longing to just keep creating music. That was sort of like the driving force inside him that's never died and is still going incredibly strong. And he's longing for those lost years when he was an addict and when he was serving time. And I grew up on CSN and CSNY and didn't know a lot about any of the members. So it was really nice to hear from him, especially just in a conversation with you, a good friend, and to really feel like we were seeing behind the wall that celebrity and fame sometimes can build. But I also learned a whole lot about so many others. David was surrounded by so many talented and gifted people, and he credits them where credit is due, of course. For example, Crosby talked a lot in episode number 2 about Allen Ginsberg and Peter Orlovsky dancing like children at early Birds shows. And Steve, you mention Allen Ginsberg in 2 separate episodes, but you don't really get the chance to explain your fascinating history with Ginsberg, Burroughs, Naropa, you know, that whole beat scene. And I'm fascinated by this history, and I think our listeners would be too, especially since it ties directly to people in a period you and Kroz discuss. Can you talk a little about this?
Sure. When I was at college, I went to Oberlin. When I was at college, at some point, the pressure just became too much. And so me and my boyfriend at the time, a guy named Ed Power, just kind of split for New York City. And the night we got there, we heard that Allen Ginsberg was giving a reading at Queens College. Now, I grew up kind of reading his poetry. It was even in some of the anthologies that I read in school, the cleaner poems, shall we say. But it wasn't until I actually saw him that night at Queens College that I really had a sense of who he was as a man. And it was a completely overwhelming experience. It was one of the major turning points of my life because I had never seen a middle-aged man who seemed so comfortable in his body and so present and so awake sort of to the now, like, you know, we hear, be here now. He was, you know, he was here now almost every time I saw him. And so I sort of made a little vow to myself that wherever he was going to be the following summer, I would be the guy that would, help him out. Like if he needed groceries or, buy cat litter at the bodega or whatever, I would be that guy, you know, to help him out. And I found out that he gave classes at a place called Naropa Institute back then. It's now Naropa University, a Buddhist college in Boulder. And so I'd never been that far west. I sold everything I had, literally everything, including my own camera. I didn't sell my clothes, but I sold, you know, anything that I could sell, I sold. And on the chance that I could become his student, I went out to Naropa. And Naropa back then was really amazing. There were Zen masters around and Tibetan Buddhist teachers and dancers and poets. And so you would have dancers talking to poets about creating a dance performance based on ancient Greek music. And it was just a completely humming and vital, intellectual, wacky, subversive community. And in the middle of, you know, the foothills to the Rocky Mountains. So it was also for, you know, a little nerd from New York and New Jersey like me, just to see the Rocky Mountains was unbelievable. And so I ended up becoming one of Allen's poetry students. I took a class in screenwriting with William Burroughs, et cetera. And so I got to see from day to day what the life of a middle-aged writer, which I now am, or perhaps even a little older, was like. And I ended up, during that summer, I ended up also going out to San Francisco for the first time, completely falling in love with it, having no idea I would end up living the rest of my life there. But, you know, obviously the beats, not Burroughs so much, but Ginsberg and Corso and Kerouac were out in San Francisco in the 50s. And the culture that they created was a huge influence on people like David Crosby and Jerry Garcia. In fact, Garcia used to talk about how he and his friends were kind of beatniks. They were like the last, remnants of the beat generation playing in coffee houses and playing traditional folk music and stuff. But then LSD happened and everything changed. And things got really interesting. And, you know, when we were talking with David, he mentioned Allen and Peter Orlovsky, who was his lover, dancing like children, as he put it, at bird shows. You can also see beautiful picture of Allen dancing in this kind of white shmata at the Human Bean, which was this concert that the Dead played and lots of other groups. Anyway, by that point, when David met Allen and Peter, David was already creating his own highly individual sound that would develop after he was fired from the Byrds for reasons that we talked about in episode 3 of this podcast. Now I want to play another extreme rarity that is just not out there, a solo acoustic demo of a song called Lady Friend that became a minor hit single for the Byrds, but had a ton of production on it that now sounds kind of dated, like horn charts and whatnot. This is just a bare bones demo, and it's very Crosby-esque, and something happens at the end that's hilarious.
Here it comes again, it's going to happen to me. Here it comes, I should have learned to duck. She's going to say she's gone away, and I will have to live without her and survive. Here it comes, it looks just like the last wave I drowned in. Here it comes, and I'm so far from shore. She's going to go and take the trinkets, and I will have to live without survive. Here it comes.
I can't even remember the rest of the record, but it's already been, I already made a record out of it. So you can listen to that one with the whole arrangement.
Typical Crosby, probably too stoned to remember the words to his own song, but it's a glorious lost piece of music anyway.
Wow, that's great. I love how this podcast has a few lost pieces of music that you can only hear in Freak Flag Flying, or possibly if you spend 4 days with David in Santa Ynez.
Yeah. You know, let me just throw in one more thing about being in Santa Ynez. You know, I was staying in a guest cottage on David's land, and it was like being in the inside of my own musical fandom brain. Like, you know, I'd look up on the wall, oh, there's the handwritten lyrics to Guinevere. Oh, there's a picture,
oh my God,
of, you know, David, you know, at Woodstock. Oh, there's, you know, it was unbelievable, really. It was just like being right inside of my fandom.
That's amazing. I kind of imagine the water, almost the Pacific, lapping up, you know, on the fields of a beautiful farm or something. That's just what's in my mind. It sounds like an amazing place.
It's a beautiful place.
You mentioned before David's incredible new music renaissance, and this Freak Flag Flying podcast served as an introduction for a lot of people, including myself, to this new music that David's embarked upon, that he's having right now with, for example, the snarky puppy band leader Michael League, and also with CPR, which stands for Crosby, Pivar, and Raymond, and the latter two being Jeff Pivar, the guitarist, and James Raymond, the keyboard player, who happens to be David's son, as you mentioned. I found it fascinating that he gave his son up for adoption, and then his son found David again when he was in his 30s. And that story alone, I'm sure, could be a podcast episode. But suffice it to say, even more incredibly, that their reunion became a musical collaboration. His father and son are collaborating now, which is amazing to me.
Yeah, that's so great. David and James have continued to work together. In fact, they're working on an album now. Earlier in the podcast, we played a tune from that upcoming album called I Think I, which is awesome. But CPR as a band no longer exists, alas. It played a very, very important role in David's life, because it was sort of, you know, the beginning of his escape from playing the hits with CSNY. And he had, you know, sort of lost heart for playing the hits in front of, you know, kind of older and older audiences. And he was making a lot of money, and it was really hard to walk away from. But as he talked about in earlier in the podcast, the band wasn't getting along, and it had become sort of a hollow exercise. But the good news is the first two CPR records, which came out in the 90s, but hardly anyone ever heard, are about to come out again from BMG in a couple of months with liner notes by me. And to write those notes, I discovered something wonderful while interviewing the guitarist, Jeff Pivar. One of the main points Crosby was making throughout the podcast was that CPR was the beginning of opening up his songwriting process to collaboration, a process that continues today with people like James Raymond and Michelle Willis and Becca Stevens and Michael League, who we mentioned earlier. I was surprised to learn that one of the most Crosby-ish sounding interludes on the first CPR record, the sparkling intro to That House, was actually composed by Jeff Pivar. Let's just listen to this short excerpt. It's so lovely, and it definitely has that kind of, you know, mysterious, sparkling Crosby vibe. But it's Jeff, actually. And so what happened was David had been impressed with Jeff's playing on some of the later CSN tours. So he invited Jeff out to California to, in a sense, audition for this new band that he was cooking up with James, CPR. But when Jeff got out to Santa Barbara, David was sick. So he invited Jeff to stay on the Mayan, the schooner where David had written Wooden Ships, Shadow Captain, and many other songs decades earlier. While Jeff was poking around in the cabin of the Mayan, he found an old guitar stashed behind a pillow. But, you know, they were on a boat. The strings had gotten rusty. So he asked himself, if I was David Crosby, where would I have put an extra set of strings? So he opened up a drawer and voila! And he wrote that beautiful intro, which practically channeled Crosby.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. One of the things that CPR did live was to open up some of David's old sort of classic tunes to collaborative reinterpretation. And James especially turned out to be a genius at refreshing some of Crosby's classic arrangements. Unfortunately, the two CPR live albums that came out after the studio albums and were released only briefly on a small label are not coming out again this spring. But let's listen to some of James' absolutely kick-ass rearrangement of Deja Vu from the out-of-print CPR album Live at the Wiltern.
if I had ever been here before, I would probably know just what to do. Don't you? If I had ever been here before, another time around the wheel, I would probably know just how to deal with all of you.
Oh, man, yeah. James is like having jazz pianist Bill Evans sitting in with your band crossed with Donald Fagen of Steely Dan. Damn.
Wow. Yep.
Tom, one of the things I've talked about with Crosby is how mysterious the process of lyric writing is. It's almost as if the lyrics sometimes know things that you don't even know consciously yet. Like, I heard you on your own podcast talking about the song Scents and Subtle Sounds by Phish, written just before the band took a hiatus. Can you please recap that and then answer a very simple question? Where do great lyrics come from? What is your process?
That's not a very simple question, but thank you for asking it. And like you said, you answered it best during this podcast when you and David were talking about songwriting and inspiration. And you mentioned a great quote, and it was by beat poet Gary Snyder, when he said, "I don't write to say what I think, I write to find out what I'm thinking." And I love that quote, and I definitely think it applies to me too. I bet it applies to a lot, many writers, probably painters and lots of artists. And I have a complex relationship with my muse where I don't really know when I'll write or why. But once I start, I can go for a while. And I guess if anything's a process, that is my process. I kind of write in bursts, and I'll write a couple songs. And then when the tank is empty, I let it fill up again. But this one that you ask about, Scents and Subtle Sounds, I won't go through the whole thing, but it starts, "If you would only stop to live one moment at a time, you would, I think, be startled by the things that you would find, like scents you never noticed and many subtle sounds, like colors in the landscape and textures of the town. And then the winds would lift you up into the sky above, and you'd be treated to a view of everything you love."
That's lovely.
And yeah, thank you. And a lot of people tell me that that's their favorite song. And that's probably 3 of 10 verses of it. But in general, the message might be to treasure moments, right? Take heed as time passes. Check out the scents and the colors and textures and open your eyes, I suppose. And one of the things that someone pointed out to me is that there's an if you would only do that at the very beginning. So it sort of becomes optional. And then it says the winds would lift you up into the sky above where you're treated to a view of everything you love. So this transformative moment is something to strive for, and it's a reward for being present and being in the moment.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. So as far as where they come from, it's extremely complex. I mean, you're a writer, so you must sort of, you know, pound your head now and then, trying to get the right word or get the right thought out. And I've found that I can't do that. I can't turn it on or turn it off. But I do like to listen to people, and they often tell me the lyrics to my next song, or at least the line or a phrase. And actually, someone yesterday was saying, and it's been going around in my head, something about a hill of doubts, a hill getting bigger or something, a hill that they'll never climb, a hill of doubts they won't climb, or something like that. And it's becoming something I'm working on.
That's great.
Or else it's something I've read. It's often walking. I walk about 4 to 5 miles a day, and all of a sudden I'll turn the music or the podcast I'm listening to off and realize that something's forming. And I often say that, you know, I'll say it into my voice recorder right away. And I like to say that the rhythm of the walking shakes it loose. So really, I'll take inspiration. Yeah. So I'll take inspiration from anywhere. And I've learned to trust the muse.
Oh, that's so great. You know, my husband, Word Q Normal on Twitter, is also a huge fish head. And he wanted me to ask you, have you ever been surprised by the way that fish fans interpret or even misinterpret a set of your lyrics? Like, what is it like when these very personal words that were in your head, like now, you know, now I can imagine like 6 months from now or maybe 6 years from now, I'll be at a fish show and I'll hear Hill of Doubts. You know, like, I remember when he mentioned that, you know. But what is what is it like when people, you know, kind of this entire huge community of fans, each bringing their own life experiences to hearing one of your songs?
Oh, man. Well, that's a great question. Thank you, Ward. Is your husband's first name
really
actually Ward?
Keith, but it's Keith.
Keith. All right. Thanks, Keith. So that's actually become a really great pleasure in my life because it now happens. It happens quite frequently. But putting something out there that means something to me, you know, like a painting that I might not have colored in completely, and then others take their brushes and finish the painting, you know, like this is one of my main best examples of this. And this was probably 10 years ago now when the song Light came out and Fish was newly back from their long hiatus in 2009 or 2010. And people didn't know the song too well yet. And after they played it a few times, a guy came up to me and he told me that he knew that I'd been in prison after he heard the lyrics to Light. And I
and you had like, not been, correct?
No, not yet. No, I have not been yet.
Not yet.
I don't plan to. Yeah, right. But I didn't laugh. I just like turned to him and looked at him like, what do you mean? And he said he couldn't stop thinking about it while he was incarcerated. And it became extremely meaningful to him. And he would repeat the words, and the obstacles are stepping stones that guide us to our goals, and fences are filters that purify our souls part. I guess somehow he was certain that I couldn't have written it without having had the same perspective.
Oh, wow. That is wonderful, Tom. Thank you so much. And I want to thank you for this podcast, which has been a wonderful experience for me and for David. And I'm very, very grateful to you and Adam Kaplan and RJ and everybody else at Osiris who worked on this. I'd like to end this epic conversation with David Crosby on an uplifting note that looks back to his deep past, but also looks to the future, and hopefully a brighter future than the present historical moment that we're all just sort of trying to get through. Here's another great live CPR track that is not being re-released, so this is your chance to hear it. One of James's rearrangements of a classic bird song. I think you'll recognize it. Enjoy, and thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much, Steve. This podcast has been a great pleasure to me and everyone at Osiris. Let's hear the song. We'll be right back.
Freak Flag Flying is proud to be sponsored by Vermont Pure CBD. Vermont Pure CBD grows their own organic hemp, processes their own oil, and makes their own products, all in Shoreham, Vermont. They use sustainable and natural methods to grow and transform hemp into healthy products, including the highest quality full-spectrum CBD products. They have tinctures and topicals, skin creams and balms, and edibles like CBD dark chocolate and even CBD capsules. Vermont Pure CBD is committed to only using the most natural, unprocessed, sustainable, and local products. They happily choose to pay more for ingredients that meet these criteria to keep the overall quality high and to support responsible producers. Vermont Pure CBD treats every plant, every product, and every customer with the care and respect they deserve. Try it out today. Go to VermontPureCBD.com and enter the code OSIRIS on the shopping cart page to get 15% off your order. Vermont Pure CBD. Enjoy your wellness. And now, we would like to announce the big winner of our Freak Flag Flying Martin Acoustic Guitar Giveaway. Congratulations, Rick Ivy. You're taking home this beautiful David Crosby and Rock the Vote inspired acoustic guitar from Martin Guitars and OSIRIS Media. Thanks for listening, Rick.
Freak Flag Flying is executive produced by Adam Kaplan and Tom Marshall. Interview, narration, and editing by me, Steve Silberman. Mixed and mastered at Telescope Audio. Promotions by Christina Collins and RJB. And thank you all for listening.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.